Right, thank you, Eilan. As the second part of this double act, I'll say things which very much echo what Eilan has already said. Now, you're looking at somebody who was ethnically cleansed in 1948. My family, I was a young child at the time, we were an example. We were an example of one of the ways in which ethnic cleansing happened in 48, which Eilan referred to as being frightened into leaving. We had to leave in. We left in April 1948. I was born in Jerusalem. We lived in Jerusalem, and the situation was extremely dangerous around us. It became more and more dangerous from the beginning of 1948. And continued to get worse until the family, in company with other families at the time, decided that the best thing to do was to evacuate and go away somewhere and wait until things calmed down. Something which happens in all conflicts and all wars. In our case, we left, fully believing we were only going away for a few weeks, and like all Palestinians, never ever occurred to us that we could never go home. Never ever occurred to us. But that's of course what happened. We left, and a few weeks later the State of Israel was declared on the 15th of May 1948, and the very first decision that was made was that none of the people of Palestine would be allowed back. And that has been the case ever since then. And Eilan's remarks about the question of the theft and the pillage of property and belongings of the people of Palestine is certainly true in the case of my family. Of course, we lost our home and anything that was in it. But my father, who was a scholar and a book collector, an avid book collector, had a very large library, which I don't know, Eilan, I haven't found out, but I dare say may well be amongst the volumes that ended up in the library of the Hebrew University. Okay, well now that's the story, and you've heard it, that's how it happened. I just want to bring out a few points and repeat maybe some of the things that have already been said from a Palestinian perspective. Indeed, it was very much the case that this having been done to the indigenous people of Palestine, it was inevitable that they would resist, of course. And now, for a very long time, the Palestinians, after the expulsion of 1948, it was so traumatic, they couldn't mobilize themselves into become, in any sense, a resistance or opposition movement to what had been done. They had their energies completely occupied trying to survive. And you can imagine how difficult that was, because, of course, expulsions, as in the nature of these things, are untidy, they're chaotic, and people ended up in different places, severed from each other, with nothing, with no money, with nothing. Of course, I should have mentioned that the bank account that we had in the bank in Palestine was also taken over by the new State of Israel, and we had little money. So I don't have to draw it out for you. You can imagine how difficult it was to try and make something of your life survive. And so for a very long time, the Palestinians became almost invisible. They became Palestinian refugees, they became Arab refugees, and almost forgotten. But of course, inevitably, in the 1960s, that changed, and the Palestinians living who'd been expelled, some of them got together and formed the Palestine Liberation Organization, the PLO, which was dedicated to trying to liberate the land from the colonial occupation and what had happened to that country. And now the reason I wanted to say this is because we need to understand what has been happening in Gaza within the context of resistance. Because unless one understands how this story began and therefore what it did to the indigenous people, it's very difficult then to understand what is going on with Gaza, you know, Hamas, what's Hamas, and so on. And of course, as the resistance of the Palestinians became more and more organized in the late 1960s, the PLO, the Palestine Resistance Movement, was an absolute cause célèbre. It was an iconic movement. It attracted people from all over the world. They flooded, young people flooded to Lebanon, to Jordan, to try to join this movement, to fight to liberate these lands and give the Palestinian people justice and restitution for the sufferings that they had undergone. Anyway, with time, the odds were too great, really too great. Remember that the Palestinians, the moment they decided to resist, found out that they were not just fighting their oppressor, their colonizer, their ethnic cleanser, Israel. They were actually fighting Israel and its friends. And we are sitting in a country which has proved to be the staunchest friend of Israel. So they took on not just Israel, but the United States and Europe. It's a very, very tall order to be able to fight a war against all that. And inevitably, the movement began to adapt itself to that reality. And so by the early 1970s, having started off with a wonderful vision of the future, really inclusive vision of a state that would be the state of the people who would live in it, whether they were Jewish or Muslim or Christian, they would live in equality. They soon realized there was a deafening silence at the other end, of course, and they realized that the odds were too great, and so they started to try and find ways in which they could salvage something, if not the whole of their homeland, then something, a foothold, a start, a first step. And that's how you began to have the long road of the two-state solution, the idea that, all right, we Palestinians, though it is our country, we have every right to return to it, we are legally allowed to return to it, and our humanity and the whole everybody's sense of decency and morality says that we can return home. We're not going to be able to, because the people living in our land will not let it happen, and the people who support them will also not let it happen. So the Palestinian movement started to say, well, all right, we will take a bit of our land, and so on. And in time, by 1988, that developed fully into what we talk about as the two-state solution. That the idea that the country would be partitioned, in fact unequally, and the smaller bit would go to the Palestinians and they would form their own state, and the larger bit would remain as Israel. And that, as you know, has never come to pass. Israel has never, ever agreed to a single peace initiative on the part of the Palestinians or of the international community. And hence, by the turn of the 21st century, the Palestinians found themselves far from getting their state or having the two-state solution accepted, far from that. They found, in fact, that what remained of their country was cut about, bisected by Israeli colonies, settlements, by roads connecting the settlements, by security areas, the wall had been built. What remained of Palestine was a Swiss cheese, a whole impossible arrangement of obstacles and barriers, making life for the people there already almost impossible to lead. And in particular, in the case of Gaza, that situation was much, much worse than anywhere else. There was a stranglehold on Gaza. People couldn't go in and out. I remember that I worked in the Palestinian areas. I worked in Ramallah in 2005. Believe me, trying to get into Gaza was one of the most difficult things I've ever known. Can you imagine? Just to actually go and pay a visit. The regime on the border of Gaza, the Israeli obstacles to entry and exit were phenomenal in 2005. And of course, later they became much, much worse. Okay, so within the same context of resistance in which I was speaking, another form of resistance appeared. In the late 1980s, the Islamist movement, Hamas, appeared. And it was, if you like, the response to a situation which the Palestinians could literally not move. It just got worse. They couldn't change it, and what was happening was that Israel was taking more and more territory, more and more land, establishing more and more settlements, putting up more and more checkpoints. So in response to that, one of the ways that the resistance movement took was to use, to go down the religious route, to and hence you had an Islamist movement, Hamas, and a smaller movement, Islamic Jihad, and ironically enough, encouraged by Israel. At the beginning, the Israelis were happy to encourage these Islamist movements. And they did that because at the time, their big enemy was the PLO. And they saw the PLO as something which had to be fought and disrupted, and they felt that if they encouraged these Islamic movements would be opposed, were opposed to the PLO, which was not a religious movement. So they encouraged the growth of Hamas. A chapter, I think, that many Israelis pretend that had never happened, but it did. And hence that developed and became more and more important as a part of the resistance, and so on. And so until you got a situation in which, by 2006, the Palestinians elected a government which was dominated by Hamas. And the moment that happened, and I'm sorry if you know all this, it's just a matter of really just going over it in order for us to get to the bit I want to really to talk about, what are we going to do. Well, by 2006, the Hamas government was elected, and what happened? Israel, the European Union, the United States immediately boycotted the new government, blockaded every effort on its part to govern in a normal way, and as a result, you ended up with a situation in which the Palestinian areas were even worse off than they had been before, because their government couldn't function, there was no money coming in, and so you had the rise in starvation, in the difficulties in daily life, and this blockade on Hamas has continued from that moment to this. And so finally we come to the most recent chapter in this terrible story, which is that by this time the Palestinian movement had been split, very much encouraged by, and I would say created by, Israeli, American and European support for one part of the Palestinians against another part. So that what you had was the Fatah government in Ramallah was funded, supported, its armies, its militias trained by Israel and the Western states, in order to overcome and defeat Hamas, which had been designated as a terrorist movement. And that process got worse and worse, so that by the summer of 2007, there was an attempt by the Fatah side of the story, the Palestinian Authority, to take over and to depose the Hamas government. And that happened in Gaza, but the Hamas people knew it was going to happen, so they preempted it by attacking the Fatah forces in Gaza first, which prompted Israel to seal the whole of Gaza. And from that moment to this, Gaza has been sealed. And so today we have a situation in which the Israelis, having imprisoned and enclosed Gaza, then attacked it at the end of 2008 with the resulting disaster for Gaza, the deaths, the wounded, the destruction of the infrastructure, and so on and so forth. So that's actually what it is. That's what the story is about. Now, I don't blame anybody in this room if you find it quite confusing, or you think to yourself, but I've heard something different, I've heard another story, because one of the most pernicious aspects of this conflict has been the persistent use by Israel of obfuscation, dust in the eyes, false stories, other narratives, myths and lies, in order to get people not to understand what happened, not to appreciate why and how this conflict arose, but to actually have their brains either confused by so many different stories they don't know where they're coming or going, or they have hold of another narrative which is entirely wrong, entirely wrong. What you have heard tonight, and I very much hope that people here who have some other kind of idea or were not clear, I hope you're much clearer about how this has happened. And now, therefore, we need to talk about what can we do about it. And I have to say, with the mess that has been created by this settler project, and by the lies, and by the collusion of the Western states, and by the support provided particularly by this country for this project, we've ended up in a situation so difficult that, quite honestly, it's almost insoluble. It would be very wrong for me to stand here and say to you, yes, yes, I've got the answer. It's virtually insoluble. And you know, it's like the, you know, the old Irish joke where this man wants to get to Dublin and he's lost. So he stops this man walking along. He says, excuse me, which is the way to Dublin? And the other man answers, well, I'll tell you this, I wouldn't start from here. And really, this is our problem. You know, I wish we didn't have to start from here. But from here we have to start. So what we now have is a demonized Palestinian leadership in Gaza, a compliant leadership in Ramallah, in the West Bank. We have Israeli settlements all over the occupied territories. We have a blockade on Gaza. We have a destruction of Gaza, starving and dying people, a ruined environment. And after all that, we still have an Israel which enjoys American and European support. Now there you are. But we need to solve it. Now, what I'm going to do is to make a few suggestions. And it seems to me that this is the way we have to go. I'm making an assumption, which I'm sure is right, that everybody in this room and many people outside this room are decent, they have a moral sense, they hate to see injustice, and they are also pragmatic and sensible enough to know that if you continue to oppress and torment people, you will always have a conflict. And therefore, the world we want is a world which is much more settled, which does not suffer from endless conflicts, which is not a cause of instability, and which does not help the creation of extremist movements. Because if we continue to allow this situation, that's exactly what we've got. Now, it seems to me that what we need to do with Israel-Palestine is, first of all, to respect the Palestinian people, to respect them as human beings with rights, and people who have rights to elect any leadership that they think is suitable for them, who believe that they have to behave in particular ways in order to gain justice. We have to respect that. And that means, in practical terms, that we have to deal with the Palestinians as a people, as a full people, and that their elected leaders are people that you have to deal with. Now, I've always said, when people have talked about this, they say, oh, the Hamas terrorists and so on, you know, I've always said to them, Palestinians have, there is not a single Israeli government that Palestinians have liked. Not one. But they have to deal with it. They deal with Israeli governments because that is the choice of the Israeli people. Likewise, the choice of the Palestinian people is a type of government you may not like, but that is their choice, and so you have to deal with it. So you have to deal with the Palestinians as a people, with rights, with elected representatives. You have to stop manipulating Palestinians. They are not there to be manipulated. They are there to achieve their rights and to be helped to do so. And they have to be helped in order to overcome the oppression that they have suffered for so long. And one of the things that is very painful for Palestinians, I have to tell you, which really rankles, is something that Ilan referred to in his talk, and is something that very often Palestinians don't talk about, but I want to mention it to you, which is the way that the Palestinians have been used to pay for the crimes of Europe against the Jews. This is the most pernicious, unjust, and evil thing that was done to the Palestinians, because you could actually, one reading of the story of Israel-Palestine could be to say that what you have here is the scapegoating of one people in order to absolve the crimes of a whole different set of people, using those people to make penance to a third set of people. The Palestinians are not Europeans. They were not responsible for the Holocaust. They have been dragged into this drama deliberately and cynically by the Europeans and by the West and by the United States, knowingly. They didn't commit this crime, yet they are paying. They paid by giving up their country, being made to give up their country. They've gone on paying to this day, and that has to end. That is part of the respect and the need to reverse these enormous injustices that were done. Okay, so what future do I see? Well, however we get there, I think there is only one future. Only one. And all the rest is a waste of time. If you want to discuss the two-state solution, obviously you can do so, but I think you're wasting time. To talk about the two-state solution today, within the context today, is a complete waste of time. If you look at the map, you'll see that there is absolutely no hope of a two-state solution. In any event, it was never a good idea. And therefore, there is only one way forward, which is to try and turn the clock back as far as we can. Once upon a time, Palestine, the country in which I was born, Palestine was a country with a pluralist society. There were Palestinian Arabs, there were people from all over the place. There were Jews, there were Christians, there were Circassians, Armenians, Europeans, Russians. All these people lived together in Palestine before 1948, in equity, in harmony, without conflict. I want that situation to come back, and I believe it can happen. Today we have a new community living in Palestine, Israeli Jews. These people now also belong to that area. And the only way forward for us is that we and they and all the other minorities there are live together in that same strip of land, small land, unpartitioned, without talking about two states, without one side stealing the water and the land of the other one, without discrimination, and without putting off the restitution of the ethnic cleansing that was carried out in 1948. The way to turn that back, to turn the clock back, is to create a single state in Israel-Palestine. That is the only future that we should work for. And I hope that everybody in this room will want to say that, with me, that this is the only way we can go forward. All other ways that you may want to think of are inherently unjust. That's the message I want to leave you with. Please remember, if you support any other than the whole country that becomes a state for all its citizens, you will be supporting injustice in one form or another. And I'm sure nobody in this room would want to do that.